Okay, let's hear a little test. Mary had a little lamb?
Well, it was nice of you to come over from... where'd you come from?
Jacksonville.
Jacksonville. Alaska, Jacksonville, and Bradenton, Florida. That's all right.
All right, it's January 6th, and I'm Dan O'Neill, and I'm with Dr. Earl Albrecht in Bradenton, Florida. And we're going to talk about his career in medicine in Alaska. But let's start, Doctor, by asking you where you were born and grew up and how you got into medicine.
Well, my father was a Moravian missionary in Western Canada, where I was born near Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, June 5th, 1905, June 25th. And then as a pastor, he moved to central United States, Minnesota, and North Dakota, where he had churches, and that's where I was raised. Studied in the East in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. And got my surgical training in Pennsylvania. And then because I was a medical person and I'm interested in the Moravian missions, I decided to go to Alaska after my training. So that gives you the story from birth to starting to work in Alaska. A few sentences.
Why Alaska, though?
Well, the Moravian Church is very interested in missions and has one in the Kuskokwim in Alaska. And in my early days, we had missions in Tibet and Nicaragua and many other places in South America and Africa. Well, I was somehow interested in Tibet because of the meeting the missionaries that had returned. And after World War I, the assignments of the Moravian Church in Europe were changed, and the North American Moravian Church took Nicaragua and Alaska. So my interests shifted from Tibet to Alaska. And then I knew missionaries that had been there in Bethel. And there was no hospital and no doctor, and so I prepared to really go up there as a physician. And the hospital, which was to be built by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, was postponed and postponed. In fact, while I was taking my surgical training in Philadelphia, I used to go to Washington and be interviewed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs medical director to get the job in Bethel. And he said, you'll have it when we get the hospital built. And it wasn't built until 39, and finally, in 39, I was being tabbed already because I was a reserve officer in the Army Medical Corps for being called into service.
Did you want the most remote place you could find? I mean, Tibet and Alaska seemed...
I think that was an incentive, although I was... as a young man, very impressed with the challenges of these remote areas, and I was raised in a cool climate, and that made a difference, and so I was happy that Alaska turned out instead of Tibet, of course. I've been, by the way, to Nepal and seen the Tibetans, know the missionaries that have been there, but glad I went to Alaska.
So tell about what it was like when you came to Alaska, under what circumstances.
Well, 50 years ago, things were a lot different. Anchorage, for example, was less than 3,000 people. And there were three MDs in the city, Dr. John Roving, Walkowski, and myself. I was the junior man. And I arrived there in June of 35 at the Anchorage Hospital, and that was a small pioneer city with wonderful people that really were making that place develop into something much more permanent, and they all looked forward to the fact the Matanuska Valley Colony was coming. That was a big opportunity. It was a new discovery for Alaska because a lot of attention was directed towards the state, the territory at that time. And we'll get into that probably a little bit more deeply. There was no road to Palmer, only the Alaska Railroad. Matanuska Station was there. That was the turn off to get to Palmer for the train. You could drive to Wasilla from Palmer. And the reason that was important was that the mines in the Lucky Shot and the Independence and Fern mines were all in operation in the 30s. And they brought their gold down to Wasilla and put it on the train. Furthermore, it took a day to drive to take the train from Anchorage to Fairbanks. We all stopped at Curry overnight, everybody did. Curry Hotel. Fairbanks was small. The University of Alaska was not a university in 1935. It was a college. College of Mines, I believe it was called, wasn't it?
Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines.
Something like that. And Dr. Bunnell was president. I got to know him very well. He was a very good friend of mine. In fact, he tried to urge me to go to the University of Alaska from Palmer, but I was satisfied with what I was doing. And one of the other things that I learned was the areas of the territory at that time were very distinct. Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, and Ketchikan. This was the same for a lot of things, but particularly in medicine. We hardly knew each other at all. And when I got to become commissioner, I traveled the whole Alaska, and I thought it was a shame we didn't work together more closely, and I helped get the Alaska Medical Association started, which was a real great step forward, because we found out that we were all working in more or less isolation and approaching things in the same way, and had a bond which was very unique. And this was very worthwhile to strengthen each group by meeting in annual meetings and corresponding and having contacts.
And there was a publication they put out, isn't there?
Well, there is now, and we didn't have much of a publication then, but our annual meetings are important. We rotated from Southeastern to the interior, which we can hardly comprehend today. The only way to get there was by boat. Yakutat was not an airport, and not until the World War II came along and an airport was built at Yakutat could we fly from Juneau, Yakutat to Anchorage. Cordova didn't have much of an airport. Valdez didn't. Of course, the Richardson Highway was always there early, but there was no connection from the Anchorage side until the war. Is this what you want to?
Yeah, but let's talk more about the colony.
Well, the colony came to fruition in April and May of 1935. And there's a little background on that is that this was Depression days, and people were on relief. And every kind of a program was developed to help people in those days. And Roosevelt and his Federal Emergency Relief Administration, called FERA, came upon the idea of sending colonists to establish their homes in the Matanuska Valley, which had been proven to be a good climate for certain type of agriculture. Had an experiment station there that for many years it had proven that there were crops that could be successfully raised. And so a plan of volunteers was established in northern Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin to find out who would like to go, move literally all the way from their home to Alaska. And there were many hundreds, I've heard thousands, and that may be true, applications, because this was a challenge and opportunity. So, as I will mention to you, the selection process was good and bad. Some agencies did not select people that were adequately prepared for a transfer into a new climate. Some of them were not well. Some of them were totally unprepared for farming. They were not interested in it, but they managed to get on the list and were on their way to Alaska in the spring of 35. Just to follow up on that, lest we should forget, the first year we sent 40 families home for various reasons, health, maladjustment, and dissatisfaction, for example. Tuberculosis was found. Bad hearts were found. One man had a wooden leg. He couldn't hack his work that he should have, would be expected to do, you know, just for his own family. But out of it all, there was a good nucleus. And it was very interesting psychologically to see the way it worked the first summer as it compared to, say, the second year. Because the first summer, I like to say it with kindness, because there were unnatural leaders became leaders. And they were complainers. And they were the ones that were taking the leadership roles in activities and decisions. And these gradually shifted down out of the package, and the real natural-born leaders arose and became the presidents and officers of this organizations. Now, I don't want to be giving you the impression that the first year we didn't have good leadership. We did. We had some people that were really took the bull by the horns and tried to get the best decisions made. I'll always remember that one of the first meetings of the colonists was to discuss what we're going to do about garbage. And they got some solutions solved and got that straightened out. Well, medically, the government made a bad decision not to give them a physician or a nurse en route nor in the valley. And when they arrived, having come on the ship, the children broke out with measles and chicken pox and probably a few cases of scarlet fever. And it was a hard trip, ship from San Francisco or from Seattle, depending on the group that they were in, and then moving into a tent, which was something that all Alaskans can appreciate, moving into a tent in April and May. And they were chuck-a-block to each other, very few feet separating one home from another home, and 200 jammed together in the flats there at Palmer. So those that made a success out of it and stuck to it, as we found many did, really deserve much commendation and praise, because it was not the easiest thing. Now, with that concentration of living, the infectious diseases could spread rapidly, and three babies unfortunately died in early in June, I think even in May. And this was the basis for a lot of complaint and concern and fear and apprehension. And Dr. Roeming, who was the senior physician at the Anchorage Hospital, was concerned and went up personally to investigate what was going on and what ought to be done. And rather dramatically, we brought things to a rapid action, because the very day that Dr. Roemig and Colonel Otto Olson, who was the manager of the Alaska Railroad, went up to the valley, the special committee that President Roosevelt was sending up to investigate all of the problems at the Matanuska Valley Colonization Project and get them straightened out also arrived. They had two doctors, one from the Public Health Service and one from the Navy, who were to look into the health aspects and report on what ought to be done. Well, they met Dr. Roemig, Colonel Olson, at Old Matanuska Station. And I've been told that the doctors on the team said, we need a doctor right away. And Roemig says, well, I have a young man from Philadelphia that I'll send up tonight if we can get him up there. And Colonel Olson said, well, we'll have to supply a special engine and train to get him up there. And the men said, well, why not do it tonight? And it really happened. Roemig came back to the anchorage and said, Earl, I want you to go up to the colony. I said, when? Oh, he said, tonight. And I sort of laughed, because that was impossible. And he said, no, there's going to be a special train. We want to send three nurses and equipment to set up a little hospital to take care of these people. And that's what happened. Another little side story is the fact that there was not a building in Palmer that we could use as a hospital. The only building that had any semblance of something permanent other than a tent was the community hall, which had three walls enclosed, and the fourth had mosquito netting over it. So the arrival of the Washington team said, that's the hospital building, so let's get it finished up tonight and get some stoves in it and some water and close that fourth wall in, and that's what they did.
So you must have packed up stuff all night. And
well, Roemig called in nurses and as I was saying, it was decided to call three nurses to pack their personal needs at once so they could report to the hospital where they would help pack medical supplies for the emergency hospital. They were Lillian Mills, Mary Bagoy, Catherine Powers. And so the four of us went up on the train, arriving at 2 o'clock in the morning. By five, we were organized enough to admit the first patient. And he had bad asthma and complications of measles or chickenpox, I don't recall. But I must insert here the fact that there was a tension and fear and a concern among the colonists because they didn't have medical personnel to take care of them. And the peace and calm that we were able to give to the folks in the valley was very impressive, and I'll never forget it all my life. They trusted us. They brought their children to the hospital and left them with them and went home and for rest and peace, because now they were being cared for. The fear of death that had occurred in three families was felt by everyone. And it wasn't the fact that it was Albrecht or Mary Bagoy or Lillian Powers. It was the fact that we represented the medical profession, and it impressed me very much, and I've never forgotten it. And the thanks and gratitude that was expressed to us at that time was very warm and enduring. And incidentally, this year was the 50th anniversary of all of this, and the experience I had with old patients coming back and with continued warmth and satisfaction that I had done something for them, delivered them, or operated on them, or as one man recalls, he had been kicked by a horse in his forehead, and he lost his eye as a result of the kick. And he was alive. That was the most we could do in those days, because we were alone and used the medicines we had, no antibiotics, no sulfa drugs. But he lived, and he came back this year in the 50th anniversary, and a little homespun story that he told me, he said, "You gave me a Popeye doll when I was a patient in the hospital." Of course, I don't remember that, but he says, "I never forgot it, and I don't know what happened to my Popeye doll, but I remember that as a patient of yours."
He was just a boy.
He was 5 years old, and it was a terrible accident, and just through a clean, sterile surgery, we were able to keep from infections from killing him. And as I said, he lost his eye, which has been replaced by an artificial eye, and he was so wonderful to see.
Well, the appreciation of the community is really evident in some of the publications you've shown me, which mark the 50th anniversary. Tell a little bit about how they really have remembered what you did.
Well, we had a wonderful grand three-day celebration in which I think about 170 persons attended who had been on the boat, some of them as five-year-old children, you see. So many of them could remember, the older ones could remember their deliveries and their surgery that I had performed, and tonsillectomies and emergency operations. We only did things that we had to do. There were gunshot wounds. I had injuries that were very prevalent, broken bones, because of their active, hard life that they were living. And transportation was abominable the first couple of years. I had to bring patients in on caterpillars, pulling them through the sleds with patients lying on the sled and the caterpillar pulling them through the bad roads. Some of them were way out of the Butte area. That was 6-8 miles. And we had the miners to take care of. They were a lot of accidents, serious accidents. So they joined us in the 50th celebration, the old homesteaders that had been in the valley and the miners that were working there at that time came to celebrate. And the appreciation that was expressed to me was very heartwarming and rewarding to me. And they wanted my picture taken with their children, and it was a heartening experience.
With transportation being so difficult, you must have done a lot more work at the hospital as opposed to house calls.
Very good question. I had forgotten, but I made it a firm rule that all babies were to be delivered at the hospital. Just for that reason, I couldn't be away from the hospital. I had to be there for routine visits, office calls, and to take care of the patients. We had a 30-bed hospital, and I know sometimes we had over 20 patients. So the colonists accepted that decision to come to the hospital for their deliveries and for their care. I made a few house calls. One was written about in the papers, in which a woman, a pregnant lady, was bleeding very severely and had to be in the hospital for us to treat and to take care of and to observe. And she's one that we had to drag in with the caterpillar. But I had gone out first to see what in the world we could do with a horse. I went out on a horseback that time. And she came through with her pregnancy and a healthy baby, so we were very correct in all that we had carried out. I think you realize that I was the only doctor, and I shudder at the things that I had to do. But I had a lot of faith, and I know my religious background made me believe in God and help and support and strength, and I had a wonderful team. Senator Ed Coffey's wife, Ruth, at that time Kelly, from Philadelphia, came, and she was my first assistant in surgery. And Max Sherrod, who's still living in the valley, and his wife Dorothy were nurses, both of them. He helped me. I trained him in the laboratory and x-ray and giving anesthetics. I'd have to give the anesthetic, start it, and go scrub, and come back and operate. And in those days, it was all drip ether. And found that that was safe and the best to use, because it could be easily controlled by the anesthetist.
Coming from a big city, Philadelphia, and undoubtedly big hospitals with lots of staff, was it hard for you to do unassisted surgeries on cases where you would have rather had some help?
Well, of course it was, but I had prepared myself to a realization that this is what I would have to do. And I wanted to have my assistant, Ruth Kelly, to come from where I was trained. And that's what was a big advantage. She knew the instruments that I was used to and trained with. She had worked at the very operating table that I had in Philadelphia. And this is no slight and insignificant matter, because we were a team. Now, it would have been disastrous for her, although I believe Ruth could have finished an operation if I couldn't. That was always the risk. But I had ectopic pregnancies, burst appendices, ruptured ulcers that had to be operated, and we didn't have any transportation excepting the railroad to Anchorage. Now, a few elective things that we could set a time for. Dr. Romig, Sr., came up from Anchorage to help me. After 2 years or so, we got a road that was passable, but that was all. It was a long ways to drive, but he did come up. But we did things. This was the turning point in medicine in which blood transfusions and intravenous therapy was just coming in. It's hard to realize it was only 50 years ago, but I was trained in that. So I set up all of the equipment. I even hate to mention it, but because it's so radical, that this, we had an ectopic pregnancy. You know what that is?
No, I don't.
An ectopic pregnancy is a tubal pregnancy, in which the pregnancy grows in the tube of the woman and then bursts and bleeds internally. There's no control at all, and they're definitely not going to survive if that bleeding point isn't treated, taken care of. So I had one patient that was just in dire straits, had bled so badly that we literally dipped out the blood and strained it and put it back into her own body through intravenous. It was a blood transfusion of her own blood. We had no time to go matching blood and so on, and it was perfectly safe. Any little clots that might have formed, we took out with cheesecloth and put it into the system that put it back into her blood, and she lived. So these are scary things, and it's hard to realize one would resort to things like that, but you won't have to.
Can you think of any other procedures that make you shudder now?
Oh yes, many of the surgical procedures. People talk about appendicitis as just a simple operation, but anybody that's done surgery knows that the appendix is not always a readily removable piece of tissue from the intestinal tract. It can be under the liver and can be retrocecal and so on. And I've had some awful cases like that. And we had the fractures that were bad, compound fractures, without any antibiotics, had to keep them clean. Of course, I was in the era of sterile technique when we really were trained that way. Sterile technique was primary to avoid any infections in the surgery and in the treatment of compound fractures and so on. But we had to.
Okay. I remember hearing about your parties you gave for all the kids of the colony. Tonsil parties.
Oh, the tonsil parties. Well, there was a subtle purpose in all of this. We wanted to cope with the transportation problem and to also avoid having the problem of having to take care of the parents where there was no place to keep them and so on, and really getting the confidence of the children. In those days, tonsillectomies were important in our beliefs. And I didn't do them just willy-nilly. They were selected. They'd been for an examination and determined and listed sometime because of a lot of infection and because of size, they should be removed. And we had a lot of children. So I would either go myself or send Max Sherrod out with the ambulance, which was a Dodge truck that had oversized wheels to get through the snowbanks and the mud. And on a special day, we would go out to collect them, about four or five of them, and bring them in, and the nurses would always have a party for them with balloons and with appropriate ice cream or some food for them, and prepare them in a harmonious sort of a way to get them ready for the next day. I think another interesting sidelight is that children are not the easiest to give an anesthetic to, particularly if it's ether. But we'd have a big cone, a mask over their nose and mouth, and we'd say, now you're gonna smell something, and if you smell it, blow it away if you don't like it. So every time they'd blow, they'd take a deeper breath, and pretty soon after five good blows, they were anesthetized. It certainly is not the techniques today, but that was worked and it got results. And then after that, they stayed in the hospital for one or two nights, depending on their progress, and were taken home with the ambulance. Because the folks had no transportation to speak of, horses, but our little unit was doing everything.
Did the kids know, or did they think it was a party?
Oh, I think they knew, but they didn't know what tonsillectomy meant, you know. And we're going to get your sore throat cut out, you know, something like that, tomorrow, but tonight we have balloons. I think you can see that I know that my studying for the ministry and a feeling for people and studying medicine necessitated an approach of good psychology and relationship and building confidence more than they just would get from a doctor. I try to do that. And sociologically, this was a very traumatic experience to move and to live under the circumstances that they did. And I believed in it for my own self and as well as for them, that we had to adjust. And one thing that I missed and they missed was entertainment of some kind, diversions. We'd go fishing, but not everybody wanted to go fishing. So I was a great lover of music, and I got the community involved through the churches and choirs, and then in the community chorus and community orchestra. And it was amazing to me to see how many people brought their instruments that nobody knew about, you know. I had a trombone, somebody had trumpets, we had quite a little orchestra. We put on concerts, and I always tell the story about the blackface entertainment we had. I was blackface and was suddenly called to the hospital for a delivery and didn't have time to clean up properly. And the mother always joked about it. She says she was really shocked when she saw the doctor have to take his mask off. But that actually happened. Of course, then that was a lot of fun in the community, just talking about the blackface doctor delivering babies. But the psychology of them developing their own parties, their own box lunches. Miners would come down and auction, and we'd arrange some money, but just the dances we put on and so on. I participated in that. I wasn't the leader in it, but had concerts at my own home. I had quite an album of music. Those who wanted to hear some classical music could come to my home and we'd have a concert. I had a big file of Bach music, which is one of my favorite composers. So the colony, if you study up on it, there's a lot been written, had a lot of great days and great moments. And there were a lot of successful, wonderful people that I had the pleasure to work with.
Talk a little bit about how you were able to keep the hospital going. It was a fairly good sized hospital and you had a fair sized staff. You must have needed to raise a lot of money.
Well, we had no money from the colonists. The system was, when I insisted on a fee basis, $75 was a total payment for a delivery, prenatal care delivery and hospitalization and postnatal care, $75. An appendectomy was $75, doctor's care in the hospital. Now that was charged against the individual's account. You've heard about the bingles that they had. That was a form of trade among the colonists, and the Alaska Rural Rehabilitation Corporation, but I didn't use Bingles in the hospital. I used the accounting system. Fee for service charged to their account, and then they had to pay the office as they could. It might take 3 years or 4 years. But that didn't bring us any cash to pay my nurses, and I had to have a minimum of 5 nurses to cover me 24 hours a day and 7 days a week, and to do surgery and so on. So as the colony went on, there was some effort to see where can we save some money. Well, it was even talked about, and fortunately the Valley people didn't know about it, that the hospital would serve only as an outpatient emergency type of facility, and the patients needing hospital care would be sent to Anchorage. And Colonel Olson was all for that because he needed to bolster up his own hospital in Anchorage. And this I fought strongly with the officials. It didn't get out to the people. But that wasn't good enough for me. I thought we've got to have some other cash income. And for the non-colonist, I insisted when I wrote my contract, they would be my private patients. You understand? Mm-hmm. The colonists, I had to take care of for $250 a month, all of them, for everything. But a homesteader, he paid $75 for his delivery and appendectomy and so on. Then I saw another source of income, and that was the miners. They were all going to Anchorage. So I saw the manager of the Independence Mine, and as much as 300 men working at one time. I said, I'll make a contract with you to take care of all of your compensable problems that you're responsible for. If they get pneumonia and it's not the mine's fault, or if they get sick from some other illness, or you abuse alcohol or whatever, that's my private practice. But for this, I will give them a pre-employment physical and give you a hospital care up to 6 months. And the fee was unbelievable, $4 per man per month. But that was $1,200 income per month, you know, 300 men. And I got $1 of the $4, and the hospital got $3. And that provided some nurses right there. And then I mustn't forget to tell you the Eklutna Vocational School, you probably never heard of that, because that's long since gone, was a wonderful institution where high school level children were brought to Eklutna from all over the territory, 140 of them. And they were just not getting any care. It bothered me. So I managed to get a contract to be medical director of the Eklutna Vocational School. And this shocked me because I found active tuberculosis there. And something needed to be done. That would be a whole story in itself. But we decided to make one wing of our 30 beds into a tuberculosis hospital wing for 5 beds in isolation, and we brought the children from that school. Well, again, that was income which supported the hospital, but it also solved the problem. Here, there were students living in dormitories, active, positive sputum, which just was unbelievable to me, coming from Philadelphia, that anything like this would be going on, especially under the auspices of the federal government. I asked, where are the x-rays of these children? Oh, we don't take x-rays. So I got them taken.